Today in this first hour, we'll be studying the book of Lamentations, which was written by Jeremiah. And the book was probably written, this long poem was probably written soon after the fall, very likely before Jeremiah was carried down into Egypt while he was still there. In a way, it's a personification of Jerusalem itself, in part, as though Jerusalem were speaking. Now, the book and its content seems to indicate what we would consider to be the proper response of the people of God in the light of the suffering and affliction that they have undergone. As I said, put in terms of a city, Jerusalem, left desolate after being captured. But it expresses that which God wants in his people. That's really for which all of this suffering and trials have come. It's an expression of a broken heart, of a contrite heart. It's expression of Jeremiah's heart on behalf of his people. It's hard to read this poem and not be brokenhearted yourself as you read it and as you feel the sorrow that Jeremiah felt. We've been studying now for some time the warnings of God through the prophet of the impending judgment of God that was going to fall on the people. God had pled with them through the prophets. He had exhorted them to return. They refused. And so the inevitable has happened. God has allowed the foreign heel to trample under for a time his people. They're overrun. They're conquered. They're carried away captive. Many of the nobler citizens of Jerusalem are no longer there. And that's why she feels so empty and so desolate. The structure of the book is also an important feature of it, which we should not miss. And I've tried to imitate that structure for you here in the outline that I've given you, and therefore we have rather a more involved outline than you would expect for such a short book. But really, I've given you a great deal of the content in this outline itself. It's an acrostic poem. And by that we mean the author has followed the letters of the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet in this case, in the composition of his poem. This is one of the characteristics of Hebrew poetry, the use of acrostics, beginning with A, B, C, and so forth. And so in chapter 1, I have tried to reflect what the author has done as best I can using the English language. So what I have done here is use the first 22 letters of our English alphabet and then in their proper order, that is, as they appear in the poem here, the names of the Hebrew letters of 22 in number. The Hebrew alphabet is 22. Not as many as our English, therefore the English alphabet runs out at Z. And it's as though he were structuring something like an alphabet book in English, where A is for this, and B is for this, and C is for this, the kind of way that children learn their alphabet. There is some relationship between the English and the Hebrew alphabet in certain places, as you may note, but these are not all reflected here. I have followed the English alphabet in order without skipping any. I followed the Hebrew alphabet from beginning to end, from Aleph to Tau. The words that are underlined here reflect the Hebrew word that begins with that particular letter. In other words, the word how in Hebrew begins with Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And to know this, then, is to know the main word of emphasis in the first verse. He has taken key words, you see, and structured a thought around these key words. And the key words are always in the order of the Hebrew alphabet. In the second line, similarly, the second verse, the Hebrew letter is Beth. And in the Hebrew, the word there means her weeping, and becomes the key word here in the poem, in the second verse. The third letter in the Hebrew alphabet is Gimel, and here it represents the Hebrew word exile. And so as we know this, and I would recommend that you underline or mark in some way these key words in each verse, you get the message, I think, more clearly. The key words that he's grappling with here, the attempt through this style of writing to communicate to the people the sadness, the sorrow of this situation, and also to lay upon their hearts some key words that have to do with their whole lesson which God has sought to teach them. So let us, following that plan now, go through it. Now, chapters 1 and chapter 2 are identical in the structure. When we come to chapter 3, however, you will see that the 22 letters of the alphabet are represented in 3 verses for each letter. In other words, in chapter 3, the first 3 verses all start with Aleph. The next 3 all start with Beit. The letter Beit is in the first letter of the word of each of the next 3. And so forth. Now, in English, the first word is not always the same, and therefore the underlining may not be the first word in your English sentence here, and the outlines are in your verse. This is because, of course, Hebrew has a different word order. But always, the first word is the alphabetized word. That is the one that has to do with the alphabet, the acrostic structure then. So that if you were to see it in Hebrew, you'd always see the first word in the verse as the key word. And the first word being alphabetized from Aleph to Tau. Then in chapter 4, it goes back to the style of chapters 1 and 2. But chapter 5 is not an acrostic at all. And raises a question of interest. Why was it coincidence or habit? And those who made up and divided it into verses, that they came out with 22 verses anyway. As exactly the same number of verses as the others, because the others followed the alphabet. Here, there is no acrostic structure in the 5th chapter, and one wonders why they came out with 22 verses. I guess they wanted to be poetic enough to be in order here. All right, let's look then at the book and its content. The first verse begins with the word how. It's the key word in the verse. It's an expression, an interjection. How does the city sit solitary? As he begins his poem, then, the first word that comes to his mind, the first striking concept is how. Oh, how this thing is expressive of the situation. How the city sits solitary, how alone it is. How awful. All of this seems to be in the mind of the writer here. She's like a widow. She's become tributary. She's no longer an independent city. She belongs now to someone else. She's not the city of David now. She's not the city of God. From his point of view, at this moment, she belongs to a foreign power. How awful. The second verse begins with the word weep. She weeps. And this expresses the whole sentiment of the entire poem, as you know, lamentation. She weeps because of her sorrow. Among all her lovers, she has no comforter. All her friends have dealt treacherously. Now he goes over in his mind the sorrows of her history, how she has been dealt with in the past. All those she put trust in have betrayed her and failed her. The one who would not have failed her, she never would put trust in. God was the only one who was certain. God was the only friend that really counted, and she never befriended him. This reminds us of Hosea's fault, of course. Her lovers not comforting her, deserting her, her friends dealing treacherously. The third verse, the key word is captivity. She's gone into exile or captivity. The word captive, captivity or exile, either one, is a proper translation of the word. Weeping, captivity, these are the ideas that come to his mind now as he begins to express the sorrowful plight of Jerusalem. She dwells among the nations, finding no rest. Her persecutors have finally overtaken her. The fourth verse, the ways of Zion. They mourn, he says, because none come to the solemn assembly. Her gates are desolate. And so by the word ways here, he probably means the paths, the main ways that one time were so busy with people going back and forth to the temple, going back and forth to the gates, going in and out of the city, serving God. All of this is desolate now, and so her ways are empty, and none treads over it, and so she mourns. Hosea 9:1 again expresses this idea of the cessation of her worship. They're particularly speaking in terms of Israel, but applicable here too. Verse 5 is the word are, the verb to be in the Hebrew. They are. Who are? Her adversaries are the head. Things have changed. Her enemies now lead her. The Lord has afflicted her. Her young are gone into captivity. Think of Daniel and his friends and all of her youth that perhaps could have done so much for her. But they've all gone into captivity. And for the most part, they'll never come back again. Daniel died in captivity, as did most of those who went. Verse 6 begins with the conjunction and. Not only what's been said, but also her majesty or her beauty is departed. Her princes are like harps. They're gone. They find no pleasure. Now, verse 7 comes to the key word, remember. Jerusalem remembers her past, her pleasures of old, her joy with the Lord in the old days. She remembers this. Now verse 8. The key word here is sinned. This is the cause of it all, after all. Now, having expressed in these first 7 verses the sorrowful plight, he now dwells for a moment on the cause of her plight, and the first word that comes to his mind is sin. Jerusalem has grievously sinned. She's like an unclean thing. All that honored her now despise her. They see her nakedness, just as Hosea predicted of Israel. Again, in verse 9, the word is filthy. Filthiness was in her skirts. So she has no comforter. The enemy has exalted himself over her. Verse 10 reminds him of the hand. not God's hand, which was there to protect her at one time, but the hand of the adversary, who now is taking all her pleasant things, who has come into her sanctuary. Who has overrun her holy places. His hand, the hand of the enemy, prevails now. She remembers that this should not be. Deuteronomy 23:3, for instance, warns against the foreigners who enter in. Verse 11 hits on the word all. Everybody sighs. Everybody's in trouble. Verse 12, nothing. As Jeremiah sees people pass by, many of them seemingly unconcerned, foreigners perhaps, we don't know who. Or maybe they're just citizens who don't any longer care. Is it nothing to you, all you that pass by? Have you ever seen any sorrow like my sorrow? I remember Jeremiah here speaking for the city, as it were, personification of the city. Now in verse 13, he begins to think in terms of what God has done. From on high he hath sent fire. The word here is from on high. He has sent fire into my bones. It prevaileth against them. He spread a net. He's turned me back. He has made me desolate. He's in bondage again. Verse 14. The key word is bound or in bondage. What is the bondage? His transgression. They're knit together. They're come on my neck. The Lord has delivered me into the hands of my enemies. Or perhaps into the hands of my sin. Verse 15, the key word is at naught, or to be set at naught. Again, it's the idea of nothingness. All my mighty men are nothing. The Lord made them as though they're nothing. He just counteracted all of their strength. My young men, everything I hoped in amounted to nothing. Verse 16 begins with the word upon. In my version it's translated for, but it's really the word upon, or because of. Upon these things, because of these things, I weep. The comforter that should refresh me is far from me. My children are desolate. The enemy prevails. All of these are reasons why he weeps. We think in terms of Isaiah 40 here. Where is the comforter that Isaiah 40 promised? Right now, far from Jerusalem. My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. Strikes the note of Genesis 3:15 in reverse. Where is the promise that God will give us triumph over our enemy? Is not the case that the enemy himself has prevailed. Verse 17, the key word is spread. Zion spread forth her hands, looking for some comforter. But there is none to comfort. You remember Isaiah when he said, you lift up your hands to pray to me, and I look at them and I see them full of blood. There's no comfort there. Jerusalem is an unclean thing. Now, lest anyone blame the Lord, now the next word in verse 18 is righteous. The Lord is righteous. I have rebelled. I'm guilty. I'm a sinner. Compare Jeremiah 12:1, for instance. Then verse 19, called is the key word. I called for my lovers and they deceived me. This is the same thing he said earlier in the chapter. in verse 2, for instance. I called on my lovers, they deceived me. Again, this goes back to Hosea, the early chapters of Hosea. My priests, my elders, everybody I looked to failed me. Jeremiah's already said this in his book of Jeremiah. Now verse 20 is addressed to the Lord. Behold, see, look, Lord, I am in distress. My heart is troubled. My heart is turned within me. I've grievously rebelled. Here's the beginning of a broken heart, the beginning of a contrite heart, a heart that feels the awfulness of his own sin. Verse 21, the key word is to hear. They have heard that I sigh. There's none to comfort. My enemies have heard of my trouble and they're glad. But then this assurance, thou wilt bring the day that thou hast proclaimed, and they will be like me. Remember in Isaiah 14, 5 and 6, for instance, or Jeremiah 30, verse 16, God warns the nations that have been glad because of the sorrow that's fallen on Jerusalem, saying that the same sorrow will come to you. Finally, the verse 22, the key word is come. Let all their wickedness come to thee, do unto them as thou hast done to me. We'll see later on that God says just the same thing, that he shall do unto them. They will get the same judgment. Remember that we saw yesterday that God stresses the point in Jeremiah that judgment must begin with God's own people. But it won't stop there. It goes on to all the unbelievers. And so this first chapter is the pouring out of the heart of Jerusalem. Chapter 2 in particular dwells in the first 8 verses on the fact that what's happened is not just an accident, it's something that God has done. It begins again with the same key word, how. How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger? He cast down the beauty of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool in his anger. Verse 2, the key word is swallowed. The Lord swallowed up the inhabitants of Jacob. Now note the preponderance of the pronoun he here. He has thrown down in his wrath. He has brought them down to the ground. He has cut off in fierce anger. And here in verse 3, the key word is cut off. He's cut them off. He's drawn back his hand from before the enemy. It's as though God had deserted Israel, but we know, as we've already seen, that it's Israel that deserted God. Verse 4, the key word is bent. And it reminds him of the bow that is bent. Like the enemy bow, God has bent his bow, like an adversary, like an enemy. You remember that Jeremiah and both he and Isaiah say it, certain places that God has become the enemy of his people. Verse 5, the word is become. The Lord has become an enemy. Note, for instance, Jeremiah 30, verse 14. He has swallowed up her places and her palaces. Verse 6 again uses the conjunction and. Not many things that start with Vav in Hebrew, but the conjunction and so you see it used here frequently. And he hath violently taken away his tabernacle, or his protecting place. You remember that we saw that God and his tabernacle are a refuge for those that put their trust in him. But now he's taken this refuge away from these who have turned from him. The Lord has caused solemn assembly and Sabbath to be forgotten. Amos warned, and so did Hosea, that this would happen. Verse 7, the key word is cast off. The Lord has cast off his altar, abhorred his sanctuary. You remember Isaiah saying that the Lord just doesn't even want your worship. It's abominable to the Lord. He'll have nothing to do with it. Verse 8, the key word is purpose. The Lord has purpose to destroy the wall of the daughters. It's part of God's plan. He has stretched out the line. You remember in Amos 7, the picture there of the line being stretched out by the wall. The Lord has stretched out the line and not withdrawn it. He has made the rampart and the wall to lament. Verse 9, the key word is sunk. The gates are sunk in the ground. The bars of the gates are broken. There's no defense left for the people. The king and the princes are among the nations where there is no law or the law. Verse 10, the word is sit. The elders sit on the ground. They're silent. They're awed. You remember Job's friends, when they come and sit down in front of Job, they just sit there for 7 days, they don't say anything. They're awed by the awfulness of what they see before them. Well, that's the feeling of the elders of Zion, of the city that are still left. They just sit there in silence. They can't believe what's happened. They cast up dust on their heads. They're girded with sackcloth. This is what Joel called for, you see. Remember when he said to the elders, come and put on sackcloth, mourn for your sins, get right with God. If they had listened, then this would have been spared them. But now they mourn. But it's too late to change the history of Jerusalem. Verse 11, the word is failed. My eyes fail with tears, my heart's troubled, my liver's poured out on the earth. Everything in me is just turned upside down and poured out. Verse 12, the phrase is to their mothers. The pathetic picture here is little children. Little children looking for something to eat. They say to their mothers, where's the grain and the wine, when they swoon as wounded people in the streets of the city. Verse 13, the word is what? What shall I testify to thee? What shall I liken to thee, daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare to thee? I've never seen anything like this. Verse 14, the word is prophets. The prophets have seen for thee false and foolish visions. How Jeremiah struggled with this problem. Jeremiah 30, verses 12 to... Excuse me, that's not the passage I wanted. But anyway, we remember in Jeremiah several times how he deals with the messages against the prophets. Verse 15, clap. All they that pass by clap their hands at thee. They hiss and wag their heads. The picture here, of course, is of people perhaps that are enemies. We'll see many of these enemies expressed later on in other passages of other books. Do you remember he asked in verse 12 of chapter 1, is it nothing to you that pass by? Have you ever seen such sorrow? Not only do they pass by, but they also clap their hands. They're enjoying the distress of God's people. Is this the city men call the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? It's a ridicule that comes out of their lips. 16 is the word opened. All he can see is the opened mouths of the people that ridicule and devour and hiss and gnash like monsters seeking to swallow her up. Verse 17, the word is done. God has done this thing. God has done what he purposed. He's fulfilled his word. Over in Deuteronomy 28:15, for instance, among many other places in the prophets, God had declared that he would do this to that city if they did not repent. Verse 18 again, the word is cry. The heart of the people cried to the Lord. Tears run down. Verse 19, the word is arise, arise, cry out in the night. It's an exhortation to all the people now to pour out their hearts, to lift their hands toward God, to plead with him. He's leading them now to true repentance, just as 1 Samuel had shown that repentance must come. So an address to God again in verse 20, "See, O Lord, and behold, to whom you've done this. Shall the women eat their fruit, the children that are dandled in their hands?" You remember that awful scene in 2 Kings 6:29 when the king saw two women fussing because they had boiled the child of one and eaten it, and then the other mother didn't want to give her child. And how awful that scene was, and it's repeated over and over, apparently. Verse 21, the word is lie. Young and old lie on the ground. Elders sitting, staring into space in bewilderment. Young men and old men lying on the ground in weakness. Some slain, some already dead. Verse 22. Thou hast called. The Lord has called. My terrors on every side. The Lord has brought all of this on us because of our sins. Now chapter 3, as we said, has divided it into groups of three verses. Verse 1, I is the key word. I am the man that has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. Jeremiah could be speaking here of himself, for he bore that affliction. He shared in that affliction and suffering of his people. Me is the key word in verse 2. He hath led me and caused me to walk in darkness and not in light. Verse 3 is surely, surely against me he's turned his hand. So we see again the personification here, not just Jeremiah alone, but the people as a whole. Those beginning with the second letter of the alphabet begin verses 4, 5, and 6. The first word is made old, or worn out. My flesh and skin he has worn out or made old. He's broken my bones. He has builded. The word builded is here the word. He's builded against me, compassed me with gall. Again in this section, verses 1 to 18 in particular, you'll note the predominance of the pronoun he. He has builded against me. Verse 6, he has made me to dwell in dark places. The key word is dark places. Verse 7, 8, and 9, beginning with the third letter of the alphabet, he's walled me in. Yea, when I cry, he has shut out my prayer. Remember in Isaiah 1, God says, I will not even hear your prayers because of your sin. He's walled up my ways. Remember in Hosea, this was said that he would wall up or bridge up her ways so she could not leave. Then 10, 11, and 12 are grouped together with key words such as bear. He's like a bear unto me, like a lion. He's turned aside my ways. He's bent his bow. He has caused the shafts of his quiver to enter my reins. I've become a derision. He has filled me with bitterness. Verse 16 begins with a conjunction again, and all three times, although verse 16 doesn't seem to reflect it in the translation I have, except in the word also, which is likewise a way to translate the conjunction and in Hebrew, so that we could begin it, also he hath broken, or and he hath broken my teeth, and removed my soul from peace. But remember Jeremiah 30, where he begins to talk about how peace can be restored. And I said, my strength has perished. Now, in verse 19, we begin a plea. And in this passage, beginning here to the end of the chapter, we have a hope passage inserted. That is, now it moves from sorrow and from recognition that all of this has come at the hand of God because of our sin. Now he begins to speak, to address God, and to exhort to hope the people. The key word is remember in verse 19, also in verse 20. Remember my affliction and my misery.
My soul has them still in remembrance. I remember them, as he said in an earlier part of this poem. This I recall to mind, and therefore I have hope. Now, the this that he refers to is probably what follows. Namely, in verse 22, it is of the Lord's loving kindness that we're not consumed. His compassion fail not. The key word in verse 23 is new. God is new and fresh every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. We come now on a great new basis toward our God. The Lord is my portion. The key word is my portion. The Lord is my portion. Therefore will I hope in him. You can see then that he's coming out of the doldrums of sadness now. He's moving out of that state of remorse into a state of assurance and hope and joy. So verse 25 and 26 and 27 all begin with the same word, good. The Lord is good to them that wait for him, that seek him. Here's a summary of the messages of Amos and Hosea and Isaiah, all of these, plus Jeremiah, that plead for the people to wait on the Lord. Verse 26, it's good that a man should hope and quietly wait. See Isaiah 30, verse 15, by comparison. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. It's good that if we have to suffer, we can suffer in our youth and we can understand and learn from it, much as Daniel, for instance, would have to do. Verses 28, 29, and 30 are all cohortative exhortations, all beginning with the 10th letter of the alphabet. Let him sit alone, keep silence, because he's laid it upon him. Let him put his mouth in the dust, so that there can be hope. Let him give his cheek to him that smites. In other words, submit to whatever discipline the Lord is going to bring on you. Good to a man that he can learn to submit. Let him submit in silence. Let him bear whatever punishment there may be. Let him put his mouth to the dust. Let him fall down prostrate if necessary, so that he can be lifted up in hope. Verses 31, 32, and 33, this grouping, all with the same Hebrew word, all in English too, begin with the word for. Because, or for, because the Lord will not cast off forever. Because though he causes grief, he will have compassion. Multitude of his loving kindness. Because he does not afflict willingly. The word here literally means from the heart. And probably it should be understood in this sense. God doesn't afflict just as an end. He doesn't punish his children just as an end. It's in order that they might learn discipline, that they might learn about him, put their trust in him, cease their sins. Some tremendous passages here about God's dealings with his people. 34 and 35 and 36 in the next grouping. To crush underfoot all the prisoners of earth, to turn aside the right of a man, to subvert man in his cause, the Lord approveth not. Now the punchline comes at the end here. God does not approve of crushing prisoners. He does not approve of turning aside the right of a man from before the Lord. He does not approve of subverting a man in his cause. These are the things, you see, that the Israelites did to one another. This is the injustice of the people toward one another. The Lord didn't approve of this, and he had to afflict, he had to punish, he had to chastise. 37 through 39, all grouped around one letter. Who is he that saith, it cometh to pass when the Lord did not command it? Out of the mouth of the Most High comes not evil and good. Wherefore does a living man complain, a man for the punishment of his sins? Why are you complaining? Why are you fussing about the complaints of God, Jerusalem? Why? Do you not expect both evil and good from God? Good if you obey, evil if you disobey. verses 40 through 42. Again, cohortatives in the sense of the plural here. Let us search, try our hearts, and turn again to the Lord. Let us lift up our heart with our hands to God. We have transgressed. We have rebelled. Now here's true confession, a true knowledge of sin that he's exhorting them to. So he moves then in verse 43 into an expansion of dealing with sin itself. Thou hast covered thyself with a cloud, no prayer can pass through. Thou hast made us an offscouring. All our enemies have opened their mouth. Fear and the pit are come on us. Streams of water, that's the way my eyes shed tears. Mine eye pours down, ceases not to cry. Verse 50, till the Lord look down, behold, mine eye affecteth my soul. Then verses 52-54, the pursuit of the enemy and his crying out again. We see something here of an identification with Jonah, it seems. In verse 54, the waters flowed over my head. I said, I'm cut off. These are almost verbatim the words of Jonah. I called upon thy name, O Lord, out of the lowest dungeon. Remember, Jeremiah had really been in a dungeon. And we know he personally cried out. And perhaps he saw that as a kind of an experience of the people being cast into the dungeon of judgment. But it was like Jonah's experience too, as he went down toward the bottom of the sea and he cried out to God for help. Now, speaking of the enemy, verse 60, well, beginning really in verse 58, Lord, thou hast pleaded the cause of my soul, redeem my life. Lord, thou hast seen my wrong and judged my cause. You've seen their vengeance, their evil devices against me. You've heard their reproach, the lips of those that rose against me. Verse 64 and 65 and 66 all end with the pronoun thou. You will render to them a recompense. You will give them a hardness of heart. You will pursue them in anger. Thus God will deal with those who have mistreated his people. Now, as we said, chapter 4 goes back to the style of chapters 1 and 2. Again, he begins with the word how. How has the gold become dim? The precious sons of Zion have become comparable to earthen pitchers now. Jackals draw out the breast. The tongue of the sucking child cleaves. He goes on again to paint the same scenes of the sorrowful state of affairs. But note in verse 11, the Lord has accomplished his wrath. He has kindled in Zion the fire. The kings of the earth believe not what God did to Jerusalem. Verse 13, it is because of her sins and of her prophet's sins and her priests that shed the blood of the innocent. So we reminded of Jeremiah 5 and 6 among many other passages. Verse 17, the cry again, our eyes do fail. Verse 18, they hunt our steps. Our pursuers are swifter than eagles. The distress now in terms of the enemy and his pursuit of the people, the outcrying of God's people as they're persecuted. Verse 21 is rather sarcastic. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. For the cup will pass through to thee. You can enjoy it now because soon you're going to have to drink the same judgment. When we get to Obadiah later on, we'll see that this is the theme of Obadiah, that the judgment of God is now poured out on Edom. Judgment on those who have enjoyed the sorrows of Israel. Finally, he closes the acrostic section of this long poem with the words, accomplished. The punishment of thine iniquity is accomplished. He will no more carry thee away. He will visit thine iniquity, O daughter of Edom. He will uncover thy sins. God is through punishing his people. You remember Isaiah struck this note in Isaiah 42 when he began his comfort passage. Your iniquity is accomplished. Jeremiah 33, 7 and 8 also the same. Now the last chapter is not an acrostic poem at all. The first verse is an appeal unto God. Remember, O Lord, what has come upon us. See our reproach. See, it's a kind of summary of what he's already been saying in the latter part of the earlier section of the poem. Now, in verses 2 to 18, he paints again the picture of the state of affairs as they are now, the suffering of the people. Our inheritance is overrun by strangers. Foreigners own our houses. We're orphans and fatherless. We have no heritage. We've drunken our water for money. We've had to pay for the water even out of the wells that we've drawn. We've had to pay for everything we eat. Even our wood is sold to us. Note the pronoun our. It's our water and our wood, but we have to pay for it. Well, is this not what God warned them long before, that all these things really belong to him, and if they did not obey, they'd be taken away from them? Our pursuers, verse 5, are on our neck. We're weary. We've given the hand to the Egyptians, to the Assyrians. Everybody's overrunning us. Now, verse 7, our fathers sinned, and they no longer are around, and we've borne their iniquity. This is an interesting statement because we see, for instance, in Jeremiah 14, 20, and 16, 12, and 31, 29, and 30, a kind of reversal of this concept. The fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. It's particularly the burden of Jeremiah and Ezekiel to say that this is no longer to be so. But he's probably expressing here in verse 7 the sentiment of the people. Well, our fathers sinned and we've borne their iniquity. We're just paying for their sin. Servants rule over us. There's none to deliver us out of their hand. This is an interesting reversal of the blessing, you know, that Noah gave to Shem, the father of the Israelites. You know, Noah said that you will be served, but now the servants have the upper hand. Verse 11, they ravished the women, the virgins, the princes were hanged, the young men bare the mill, that is, they had to grind at the mill, much as you remember Samson was forced to grind at the mill of the Philistines. The children stumble under wood, the picture being little children being forced to carry heavy loads of wood. Some of these things strike a particular note to me as I recall seeing in Korea in particular some of the children that had to struggle under heavy burdens over there. I remember little children, well, little boys having to learn from a very young point to carry heavy burdens on their backs and we used to call an A-frame, but loaded down with wood, heavy burdens. And poor old men that from childhood had learned to bear these burdens, carrying weights of sometimes 200 pounds on their back and carrying it up long hills and up mountains with nothing more on their feet than little sandals made of straw. Elders have ceased from the gate, young men from music. 15 is particularly significant. The joy of our heart is ceased. You remember that Joel warned that this was the greatest sign of distress for the people. Joy was no longer in the hearts of the people. You remember that David in Psalm 51 pled with the Lord, Lord, restore this joy that I have lost because of my sin. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe unto us. We have sinned. They've come then to the point of confession of sin, and this is what God requires. so it ends on great hope. Thou, Lord, abides forever. Thy throne is from generation to generation. Forsake us not so long. Turn thou us unto thee, and we shall be turned. This, by the way, goes back to a question that was asked yesterday about Jeremiah 31:18-19. The question was asked why in some versions, let's just look at that a moment, why in some versions it's translated after I turned, I repented. Well, I checked the Hebrew out on this, and the Hebrew of it literally simply means my turning, after my turning. Now, my turning could be either active or passive. It would be neutral as far as voice is concerned in the Hebrew form there. But the next section here, after I was instructed, is clearly passive. But above there, turn thou me, and I shall be turned, would also seem to imply that the proper translation here should be after I was turned and not after I turned. It would follow the sequence here more properly, and I think, therefore, that the translation in the ASV is justified more than the new ASV. And while the Hebrew word there isolated could be either I turned or I was turned, in the context, the strong weight of evidence would be for the passive. But here we have, in verse 21, the same concept. Turn us and we will be turned. Lord, you've got to do it. You've got to change us. It's only by what you do. And of course, that was the thrust of the message of Jeremiah chapter 31, that God is going to do what we cannot do. Thou hast utterly rejected us. Thou art very wroth against us. It ends then on this agonizing cry, and Jeremiah still feels the brunt of the awfulness of this thing, the sting of God's rebuke, even as he writes this and even as he closes it. Though it closes on a note of hope, a plea with God to change, to make them no longer sinners, still the sting is left, and it leaves us then in the whole book with the overall impression of deep mournfulness. And as you study the life of Jeremiah, and particularly the agony that he must have felt as he was dragged off down into Egypt, this poor man forced to go into Egypt where he knew God would not have his people to go. So the Book of Lamentations is a beautiful book. To study it according to the acrostic structure, I think, is important if you're going to get the sense of the meaning here and particularly know these key words. Just read through those key words, and each one of them has a certain amount of weight behind it. All right, we'll pause now for our...